Okay, we'll resume the Forest Practices Board regular meeting. We're going to alter our agenda sequence this afternoon a bit to ensure that we take our afternoon public comment starting right at 1:00. So Darren, could I call you up to provide the review of the settlement agreement surrounding the Forest Practices Habitat Conservation Plan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As you've heard, we do have a final settlement agreement. But I'm going to rewind a bit. If you recall from the board meetings earlier in the year, the Conservation Caucus sent a letter to state federal agencies in December outlining some concerns with implementation of Forest Practices HCP that needed to be addressed in order to avoid litigation on the issuance of permits for that HCP. Some of the topics that the caucus wished to address was the probably most importantly the need for stable, dedicated, long-term funding for the adaptive management program and improvements to how adaptive management functions, as we discussed this morning at length. There was also some elements regarding improved compliance and better enforcement. That December letter was followed up by an email from the caucus in February that further clarified some of those issues, so we had a better understanding of their perspective on those topics. During the winter, conversations ensued initially between the Conservation Caucus and the industry regarding those issues and possible solutions to those issues that would forestall litigation, and the state joined in those conversations shortly thereafter, early in the spring. Upon further discussion with the Conservation Caucus, we moved the compliance and enforcement issues outside of the agreement to be worked on directly with those folks. And the negotiations leading up to the final settlement agreement focused primarily on a renewed commitment for collaboration and consensus building amongst all cooperators, changes to the Forest Practices HCP implementing agreement with regard to baseline funding necessary to meet the commitments in the HCP, reforms to the adaptive management process, and a prioritized CMER schedule that looked out about 20 years and tried to schedule out priority projects across that time frame and get a sense of the annual funding need to accomplish those projects within that time frame. And then the need for the board to regularly review, adopt, and hear about progress on implementing that schedule. So on May 24th, we concluded the negotiations with an executed and signed settlement agreement. And since that time, a number of things have happened or will happen to implement the agreement. The first thing was immediately upon execution of the settlement agreement, we worked with Federal Services to make a minor amendment to the implementing agreement to the HCP that I just mentioned. And that was accomplished before the end of May, which was the time frame on the litigation, the statute of limitations basically on the litigation. So we accomplished that amendment. It is in place today, and it specifies a specific amount of funding, baseline funding for the program necessary to meet the commitments in the HCP. We're also in the process of retaining a professional neutral facilitator for policy to help them with improving collaboration and building consensus. And the remaining commitments in the settlement agreement regarding adaptive management process, the schedule for CMER projects, those sorts of things, are moved into the adaptive management process. All those changes that the three parties committed to advocating for must go through the adaptive management process by current rule of law. So it's a proposal. And we prepared that proposal last week and turned it over to Jim on Friday. He did his work on evaluating the proposal, answering the questions in Board Manual 22, and forwarded a recommendation to policy, and I believe that occurred yesterday. And on Thursday, we will have a special policy meeting scheduled to take up that proposal and begin the deliberations on the proposal, and hopefully we can make some progress on that. We have a deadline specified in the settlement agreement of December, end of December next year, to accomplish improvements and adoption of a schedule those sorts of things, consistent with the settlement agreement, recognizing that parties that were not involved in the settlement agreement discussions will have their own ideas about how to improve the process and may have their own sets of priorities for projects. We'll have to work through those issues in the adaptive management program. And that will get kicked off on Thursday. So that's a high-level summary of what's in the settlement agreement. I believe you all have a copy in your packet that was given to you this morning. And you can wade through all the details. We'll provide updates at each regular board meeting on the progress of the adaptive management proposal as we move along towards the deadline. Questions?
How soon for a facilitator?
Jim here?
No, he's not.
We're in the process of working through GA. They have master contracts in place that we can hire from. So we're right in the middle of evaluating whether those are going to meet our needs, whether there's enough qualified consultants on those lists to take advantage of those more expedited procurement processes through what's DES now, the Department of Enterprise Services, or if we're going to have to go out with a broad advertisement. So right in the midst of that, and at the Thursday policy meeting I mentioned, Jim is going to queue up a discussion about the type of process that policy wants to follow in hiring a facilitator. In the settlement agreement, it mentions a policy having a role in interviewing and selecting the facilitator. So we're going to try to get that nailed down on Thursday. Then we just need to get the actual state procurement process going, which we're very, very close to being ready to launch on.
But on the outside, if you went outside of the general list,
that'll take a little longer. But we should be able to, I think within the next month or two, get this accomplished.
Okay.
Other questions for Darren on the settlement agreement?
You mentioned some changes to the adaptive management program. Have those been specified? And if so, would we be having a different discussion about the postmortem study? Are some of the things that happened in that study, have they been addressed in the...
They are specified. If you read through the settlement agreement, you'll see some of the items regarding the process that the three parties agreed to. Probably don't go to quite that level of detail, so I can't say whether it would have prevented the high centering on the postmortem. But there is a proposal to truncate the dispute resolution process. So at a minimum, if we had that in place, the dispute resolution process would be shortened considerably from 9 months at least down to about 4 or 5. And so there's other ideas about process improvements that certainly could help minimize or prevent those types of situations occurring in the future. But they're not super specific in the settlement agreement. That certainly doesn't preclude anybody from bringing up ideas that can help solve those problems. And whenever we have these kind of things, we've only had, if you recall, a handful of projects go all the way through the process. That are of this scope. And every time we do that, we learn something about our process and how we interact with each other and how we can make things work better in the future. It's always going to be messy because that's just the nature of the business, but I think each time we get through one of these, we can make improvements. And certainly we have an opportunity with the lien process and with the settlement agreement discussions to make those types of improvements. Okay, thank you.
Mark, could you update us on the rulemaking timeline for HPA-FPA integration?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm Mark Engel. I'm the Assistant Division Manager for Forest Practices. In your packet, you've got a memo from Darren that I'm doing the presentation on. Senate Bill 6406, there are some very distinct due dates, milestones, so to speak, within this bill that the board has to meet. If you look on the back page of the memo, it gives the timeline. At the top, it lists the dates for the board, DNR, and Department of Fish and Wildlife. What's really and those dates are where the milestones have to be met. At the bottom is the timeline for board activities. So we'll go there real quickly. We are, as you know, later today, I'm going to address some rulemakings. The first one is the rulemaking conversion activities, which is now fits within this timeline. Also, your next meeting, your November meeting, is your planning meeting for calendar year 2013. So there may be a number of other rulemakings, including potential rulemakings that we may discuss from the settlement agreement. So this is a good timeline to try to fit in with all the other rulemakings that we're going to bring forward and for you folks to consider before the November meeting when we set the next year's work plan. On the timeline for the board activities in the under Senate Bill 6406, we're actually starting today. This when we bring forward the CR, the request for the board to consider directing staff to file a CR 102 to begin rulemaking on the conversion activities rulemaking. That rulemaking, in large part, is from bills that the legislature has passed, including 6406. It'd be the first step where we extend the time frame for a approved forest practice from 2 to 3 years and for a renewal from 2 to 3 years. So we're technically going to start the process today. Also, when you're reading the timeline at the top, the bottom date, so the 8-14, 11-13, et cetera, those are your board meetings. So what we're doing is we've listed the work that is to be done between board meetings and what will be brought to the board at that board meeting. So between this board meeting and the November board meeting, DNR will initiate a stakeholder assembling of a stakeholder group and begin looking at the writing of the board manual. Again, at the top, the board manual is due by December 31st of 2013. Board manuals can be quite technical, and so we want to convene the stakeholder process beginning in September. Again, as Darren said, for the settlement agreement, we will bring updates to the board at every board meeting as to the progress. Also, during the period between this board meeting and the November board meeting, Department of Fish and Wildlife, who has to, when you look at their deadline, by December 31st of 2013, they have to do rulemaking, establishing the procedures for a concurrence review process. So again, this is the integration of hydraulic projects into the forest practices rules. The expertise on certain projects is still on wildlife, so the legislation has asked for an additional 30-day period to be added to the review of forest practices to give wildlife the opportunity to review the hydraulic project portion for concurrence and reporting to the DNR. Between this meeting and November, wildlife is going to file the CR 102 to begin their rulemaking process to put together their concurrence process. Between November and February, wildlife is going to be doing public comment and their public hearing on that. They're looking to have that process in rule effective in early March, which will really assist the DNR in our rulemaking because we want to initiate at the February meeting have the board direct staff to file the CR 102 to begin rulemaking at the February meeting. Our eye is towards bringing final rule to the board for adoption on the integration of the current wildlife rules for fish passage standards by the May meeting of next year. So, a lot of detail here on this. Are there any questions?
So, is there or will there be an adaptive management process on the actual fish protection standards? So WFW, there's law on WFW has its guidelines on the fish protection standards that are being incorporated into our rules. Once they're incorporated, is that then going to go through adaptive management process? I mean, if there's new science that says, you know, these standards aren't what they need to be, will they be brought up to snuff over time the way all the other aspects of horse and fish rules are?
Well, before Dave speaks, excuse me, board member Whipple. There's a jar behind me. I just put something in. The legislation asks or requires the board to incorporate the current fish standard, fish protection standards into the rule. And then as Department of Fish and Wildlife updates those standards, those will be incorporated. At this time, Department of Fish and Wildlife is undertaking a rulemaking to update their fish passage standards. That rulemaking is separate from this bill, and that they're not required to do that at this time. They're choosing to do that. The timeline for their completion of this rulemaking it will not allow us to wait for that first before we incorporate. So.
Mark answered, you know, basically said what I was going to say. There is an intersection between the forest and fish rules, via the forest and fish report and Appendix M, that talks about if Department of Fish and Wildlife changes the standards and requires, I guess, ways to implement those standards that are over and above what is currently being conducted or required, then there's a feedback loop that goes to our Forest and Fish Adaptive Management Program. But our standards are subject to our own internal monitoring, compliance monitoring, effectiveness monitoring efforts that we're doing.
Are there questions for Mark? Good. Thank you, Mark. Stephen, could we move up yours and Adrian's report on enforcement fish policy priorities?
Sure. For the record, I'm Stephen Bernath. I'm the Forest Policy Lead for the Department of Ecology, and I'm co-chair of the Forest and Fish Policy Group. And I'm here representing the co-chairs. As you know, and as Mark alluded to a few minutes ago, you're coming up, your next meeting will be your planning meeting. And so we're asked to come every August to tell you what we think our priorities will be for the coming calendar year so that you can work that in with your and be aware of what we're going to be up to and also look to, if you so choose, look to support the priorities that we identify in the memo. So just to bring you up to date, as you recall, we came to you last November with two priorities. One was to work on a tight band water strategy. That's both making sure that the science we want to come out on tight bands is solid. So review all the questions we're asking, making sure that the science that is already in process is headed in the direction that we think it will be helpful to us, and then also try and determine whether we need to do anything more regarding finding the upper perennial point on the landscape on a regular basis. And so we've split our group. We've got a sub-policy group that is working on the policy issues around the science. We've worked through a lot of those issues. We still need to finish up the discussions around amphibians and what we need to learn about amphibians and their and the contribution of tight band strategy to that. And the technical subgroup has also been formed and been working, and they just delivered a report to us at the last policy meeting. So we will be very soon going through that. In fact, Thursday afternoon we'll be going through that report looking at what the technical subgroup recommends to the policy subgroup. So that's moving along nicely. The water typing group is being chaired by Adrian, and it's moving along as well. They're trying to find a path to see how we can go from the current situation we're in on water typing, the interim rule, you know, forced practice rule, and move to a permanent rule. And that is continues to move along. The two new items on our agenda this next year will be pretty interesting. We think that there will be a role for many of us on the HPA-FPA integration. And so there, and so that's going to be a workload that we're going to have to take into account as we move forward. And also, as mentioned by God, I'm having a terrible time, by Darren on the settlement agreement discussion previously, there's two proposals within the settlement agreement to have a master seamer list, which we need to take through the adaptive management process, and some process changes to the policy group. And so those will take up a lot of our time this coming year. You've already heard this morning there's a dispute that we're trying to work through on the postmortem project. We hope that to finish that this year and not have that flow in next year. And on top of that, we have core work to do, meaning we anticipate two or three studies coming to us in the next year that policy will have to deal with, final reports that we will have to look at from a policy perspective and then make recommendations to this body. So all in all, we expect to have a full workload this next year, and we just would ask to remind you that generally we all wear many different hats, and whether it's rulemaking that's going on, work on the policy group, or other issues that are happening in the forced practices arena, many of us have several different hats, and so this represents a pretty full workload. And we'd like you to take that into account as you look at your workload for next year. And that's all I have to share. Are there any questions?
What studies do you anticipate are forthcoming to policy next year?
Oh, I was afraid you would ask that. Is Jim here?
Yeah.
Jim.
Well, cross your fingers. Well, I guess both of us know that.
Obviously, postmortem hopefully will be done, and we'll have a policy discussion
with the recommendations to the board. So that would be one. Another one is, of course, you're getting the solar and BCIF today, and along with solar comes along a temperature shade study being done in Eastern Washington. On the effectiveness of the rules in bull trout overlay. That would be another one. And then we have an east side type F. Most of our studies that you've seen have been type M. A type F extensive status and trends study that hopefully should be done and coming your way next year. Possibly the west side type N and type F extensive status and trends as well. We're trying to move those parallel with type F, but type F is quite a bit ahead. And there should be one more, but it's kind of slipping my mind. The soft rock? Just got started.
Hard rock.
That's 2014. It's progressing. Oh, there's an amphibian literature review that hopefully should be coming next year, highly likely. And then one that we call and is in your work plan called the buffer shade, but it's actually a buffer shade on the west side, and it is an amphibian study that is hasn't gone to ISPR, so if it goes to ISPR soon, it should be coming to policy and then to the board next year as well. So there's actually quite a few studies that potentially could be coming to the board next year.
Those are all inbound from CMER to policy, and you think you're going to deal with them and pass them all through to the board next year?
They're inbound to CMER and ISPR at this point. Now, a couple of them, the Type F extensive, for example, has already gone through ISPR, so it's going through revision, and then would come to policy. That's fairly soon.
And you're optimistic you can policy will be able to address all of those and forward a recommendation to the board?
That's that new lead process.
Well, so far I think...
there's no right answer to this.
There's no right answer. But most, I would say that policy has dealt with most of the reports that have come to it in the last year and a half, fairly quickly. It even, with the BCIF report that I'm reporting on this afternoon, it even went through dispute resolution and was resolved within 2 months, I believe. If not two, then three. So, yes, I think optimistically that if they get to policy, that policy can get whatever issues they have to resolve in terms of recommendations to the board.
That's good news. Thank you. Other comments or questions for Stephen or Jeff? Thank you. Okay, that puts us right back on time for our 1 o'clock public comment period. Patricia, do we have anyone signed for public comment?
You don't have to sell it.
What? I'm later, I think, with the 3 o'clock one. But is this Forest Biomass or not?
No.
This is general comment for afternoon. No. Okay. No one signed for general public comment for the afternoon. Is there anyone in the audience who did not sign up but would like to provide general comment at this time? Stephen.
Just this is regarding the HPA PA integration rule. Because it involves water and hopefully clean water, ecology, most of those rules will probably be asterisk, and ecology will have to go through their process pertaining to that.
Great. Thank you. Chris?
Yeah, I'd like to speak briefly on a presentation or that Rachel Jameson is going to give on the forest biomass, energy, climate. Just wanted to say that having the Conservation Caucus participate in that process, it was over a year of meetings. I was there as one of the representatives. Board member Norm Sharp was there and several others. But it was a successful process, and I think that we all learned a lot about forest biomass issues. I won't go into the details of what that was, but I think it was probably a really good example of a collaborative effort that took some time. But at the end of that time, everyone came to agreement on what recommendations were going to be made to the board. And I guess in closing, I'd just like to thank the dean, our staff, for helping with that process. And also, you know, my general take on it was that if people take the time to learn what's really going on out there with forest management and forest products, and particularly this case with forest biomass. And I think the more time you take to do that, often you can come out with people in agreement on what some of the issues are. And the one striking moment for me, I think, was the Eastern Washington tour. We looked at some of the fire health issues, and I think there was one of the commissioners came in today and talked about forest health issues on the east side. And what a challenge that is, given the nature of the treatments, the cost of them that they don't really pay, and how, you know, you need subsidies to pretty much to treat those forests, but what a big problem it is to get to that. So that was sort of the light bulb coming off for me in Eastern Washington anyway, and probably will pose one of the largest challenges, I think, to the group, given that most of the biomass harvesting isn't on the east side, it's on the west side. So with that, again, I want to thank everyone who participated in that and for giving the Conservation Caucus the opportunity. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to provide a general comment to the board? Okay, we'll move on to our next agenda item, which is, in fact, a report on the forest biomass work group from Rachel and Mark.
Just in case. Someone asked a technical question. I want to answer. I was real worried when you walked in.
Did you just read all that before?
Yeah, she's got 20 minutes of presentation. We're ambitious. Well, first I want to thank you all for having us today and just say that this, to reiterate some of what Chris had said, this was really an extremely constructive, productive, educational for all of the table process. And I want to thank the staff and our forest practices staff who spent hours and hours pulling together different groupings of the rules for us, and the Conservation Caucus as well, who also spent hours and hours pulling together pieces of scientific research on different aspects of the rules that we were looking at, as well as everyone else who is on the committee who contributed science as we were moving ahead to ensure that our discussions were grounded in the most current science and the rules as they are actually written. So it is a great pleasure that I'm here today to present the outcomes of this work group. We have a PowerPoint presentation. So I'm going to go over first just a little bit about the work group. I want to take a moment again to comment on who was there. The purpose of the group, I'll go through the topics that we addressed. I'll then move through the consensus recommendations. We had one non-consensus recommendation I'll go over, and then also one request to DNR, and then a summary of where we went. So as you can see, the committee was comprised of a broad number of folks, many of whom are in the room, many of whom are at your table. Norm, Dave, Chris, there's a number of folks in the back of the room here. So. Again, to thank them for all of the time. We added up the hours that we had spent in meetings going over the rules, and it was a total of 84 hours just in the meetings, not considering all of the work outside. So there was a lot of really good work that went into this. The purpose of the group, per the group's charter, was to educate ourselves on the science, policy, and available technologies related to biomass harvest, the forest practices rules that apply to such harvest, and biomass harvest BMPs. Discuss and determine if specific BMPs and or forest practices rules and or rule revisions related to forest biomass harvest are needed in Washington, and if so, identify a path toward identifying what is needed. So the topics that were addressed, we often had day-long meetings dedicated to each of the topics. For the forest practice rules in general, we wanted to make sure that we started the process with a firm grounding in what the rules said. Best management practices and resource considerations. We wanted to make sure here, too, that we started the process with a clear understanding of the concerns and the risks that we wanted to keep our eyes out for throughout the process. And then we got into the topics themselves, soil health and productivity, civic culture and roads, disturbance, deadwood slash disposal and carbon storage, water quality, riparian zones, unstable slopes and water infiltration, and finally, wildlife, biodiversity, and cultural resources. In addition to these meetings, as was mentioned earlier, we took one tour of Westside Biomass Collection and a tour of the east side, which was primarily forest health issues, because as we all know, there is a serious lack of a market for any biomass. So where there were chips or biomass produced, often we were told the fates of those. Often it was chipped and put back on the site. So we'll get into our consensus recommendations. And you all should have received a document so you can read along. I'm also more than comfortable being interrupted as we go. So if a question comes up and you don't want to wait till the end, just flag me down or let me know and I'm happy to stop. So first, the group by consensus recommends that a definition of forest biomass be added to the forest practices rules. That definition would read, forest biomass means material from trees and woody plants that are byproducts of forest management, ecosystem restoration, or hazardous fuel reduction treatments on forest land. Although stumps are a byproduct of these activities, only those removed for the purpose of road and landing construction, forest health treatments, or conversion activities may qualify as forest biomass. The group also, by consensus, would like to recommend that further revision of the definition of forest practice be added to the forest practices rules. To read as follows, forest practice means any activity conducted on or directly pertaining to forest land and relating to the growing and removal through harvesting or processing of timber or forest biomass, and then it remains the same to the end as it's currently written. We would like to recommend that the forest practices, biomass recommends the Forest Practice Board prioritize the identification of funding to finish the landscape level wildlife assessment models. This will provide necessary information to determine whether existing requirements are sufficient or if a rule change is necessary to ensure wildlife habitat is sufficiently provided for in the forest practices rules. Moving on to another topic, RMZ retention. Given that the rules currently don't have fine woody debris requirements, increased intensity of biomass harvesting may require an adaptive management review of the efficacy of rules to maintain and protect riparian function where biomass harvest has occurred within RMZ inner and outer zones. A particular interest is the importance of fine woody debris in the retention of fine sediments to meet riparian function within the RMZ. It's expected that such review can inform quantitative retention thresholds. The group would like to ask DNR to consider adding an element to the compliance monitoring program during the time prior to an adaptive management process to estimate the percentage or quantity of post-timber harvest biomass that remains on site. We recognize this is outside the current purview of compliance monitoring activities and responsibilities, but the recommendation still holds. The group also asks you to consider developing the following guidance with regard to harvest of biomass in the managed portion of the inner zone. The only biomass harvested from the managed portion of the inner zone should be a function of site prep and forest health improvements. So to really narrow the scope of what can go on there. Upland retention. The forest practice rules, as you know, require retention of specific numbers and sizes of snags and logs currently, and also provide protection of forest soils and prevention of sedimentation into tight water. Snags, so I want to also just throw in here, I'm reading a lot because we spent a lot of time going over this language, and out of respect to the process, I want to make sure that I'm delivering this as the group had consensus. So. Snags, as well as coarse and fine woody debris, are important habitat elements for many wildlife species. Today's biomass harvest rates, driven by market conditions, result in current forest biomass harvest being limited to the removal of post-timber harvest woody material. If this changes, the issue should be revisited. The Forest Practice Biomass Workgroup recommends the Forest Practices Board pursue funding and collaboration opportunities for the Wildlife Workgroup to complete the following after the completion of the LLWA models and before the end of 2016. One, reevaluate biomass harvest practices using the LLWA habitat models or similar tool in light of the lack of knowledge of the potential effects of biomass harvest under different harvest rates and conditions. Two, develop and implement a practical and reliable methodology or tool to accurately estimate the amount and characteristics of biomass left on a sample of harvest units after a timber harvest and biomass removal. This can provide data for the LLWA models. Here again, identify funding sources to complete this work, and the Forest Practice Board will ensure, we'd like you to ensure, that the Wildlife Work Group provides an annual review of progress on this effort to convey to the interested stakeholders progress on that effort. I want to pause, see if there are any questions so far. Great. So this relates to slope. The Forest Practice Biomass Workgroup recommends the following revision be made to WAC 222-30020 related to harvest unit planning and design. We recommend that it be changed to read logging systems, including forest biomass removal operations, must be appropriate for the terrain, soils, and timber type so that yarding and skidding can be economically accomplished and achieve ecological goals of the rule. Continuing on with road abandonment, the Forest Biomass Work Group determined that no rule changes or BMPs were needed to address road abandonment and timing issues. We recommend to DNR Forest Practices Program, however, that when biomass is being harvested after the timber harvest is complete, when the biomass has had time to cure on site for a period of time, that the forest practice application be conditioned with the two-day notification requirement under existing rule WAC 222-22040. The group formally requests DNR to direct forest practices foresters and notify landowners and operators, perhaps at TFW meetings, that this will be considered in the conditioning of FPAs that include the removal of forest biomass. State timber contracts and road abandonment and reabandonment. The group determined that no forest practice rule action is necessary to address this issue that was raised. The work group wanted to recognize the high priority that RMAPs are given by DNR state lands and acknowledge the dialogue will remain open with regards to DNR state lands progress on developing contracts short and long term for the sale of forest biomass from state lands that don't conflict with RMAP priorities or compliance with other road issues. Soil quality. The group requests that the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee consider undertaking the following project to assist small forest landowners. There was quite a bit of discussion about existing activities that industrial landowners already do in this arena, and that there was a lack of resources for small forest landowners to do this work. So that's why there's a focus here on the small forest landowners. One, develop a nutrient risk assessment tool that small forest landowners can use to determine if soil nutrient deficiencies exist on their forest lands. Develop education and outreach materials for small forest landowners to use to assess soil nutrients and potential risks to physical properties associated with timber productivity. That could include best management practices. And seeking funding for these efforts through NRCS. Carbon storage, we recognize, is outside of the current purview of the forest practice rules, but it came up as an issue. And the group determined that no action is necessary to address this issue. The work group determined it's beyond the scope of the committee's objectives, and if addressed, would need to be done so in a different forum.
Rachel, can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. Did you guys talk at all about the overlap with Department of Ecology's new CEPA guidance on needing to quantify greenhouse gas emissions? Did that come up at all in your discussions?
CEPA in particular did not come up in our discussions. Obviously, any activity would have to go through CEPA, so that never came up. Not all activities. So no, that didn't. The group also came up with several five-year recommendations. These are recommendations that didn't need immediate attention, but that we want to revisit as the industry continues to mature over time. The question of whether reforestation species will shift for biomass production was raised, particularly in the RMZ outer zone. And the question of whether shrubby vegetation will be collected in the future for utilization as biomass was raised. Concerns were raised about collection of shrubs from the inner zone, and there may be a need to revise the rules that relate to what can and can't be harvested in the inner zone of the RMZ and your unstable slopes. Again, those are not issues currently. The issue also about snags and LNI, that was quite an educational moment, I think, for a lot of us, that LNI requirements often ask that the snags be taken down. And then there is also the fact that, you know, a lot of this activity is directed by a dynamic forest products market. And so we just wanted to make sure that those were captured as things to sort of keep in our mind for the next 5 years. We had one non-consensus recommendation. It's the question of whether all forest practice rules could apply a standard of ecosystem functionality was raised. There are differences in opinion on whether or not the Forest Practices Act and rules address ecosystem functionality. The group agreed that no agreement was possible, and there are two perspectives that emerged in the discussion. Not all participants' views are represented by these two positions. Position number one was the Forest Practices Act states that coincident with the maintenance of a viable forest products industry, it's important to afford protection to forest soils, fisheries, wildlife, water quality and quantity, air quality, recreation, and scenic beauty. This legislative finding and declaration does not include ecosystem functionality, a concept that is not universally or well-defined. Ecosystem functionality could be applied to the forest practices rules, including biomass harvest when directed by the legislature. So that was the first position. The second position is biomass harvest may negatively impact biological diversity and ecosystem functionality, especially through cumulative impacts to public resources and forest health. Hence, the following concepts need to be added to either the forest practice rules and or board manual. Forest biomass harvest shall, one, be planned in the context of the larger landscape in which it is located across the full harvest cycle, two, maximize habitat structural complexity and spatial heterogeneity, three, mimic natural disturbances or intermediate frequency scales and intensity of disturbance, and four, retain and recruit biological legacies, dogwood and snags of varied size, species, and decay class, understory vegetation, and a well-developed forest floor. So those are the two positions in our one non-consensus outcome. And finally, we had one recommendation that's actually to DNR, not to the Forest Practice Board, and that is that the DNR undertake a QAQC review of the methods and models used in the 2012 UW DNR statewide forest biomass supply assessment. So at that, I'm happy to take some questions. That is the outcome of a lot of hard work.
Questions for Rachel and Mark. Dave.
Got a question. Just on the addition of the language in the definition of forest practice and removal through, what is the intent of that? Is it that if you don't remove, it's not a forest practice, or I'm not seeing the value added?
We want it to be consistent, so removal, from a semantic standpoint, when talking about biomass, removal through harvesting or processing, that's consistent with other rules that we have looked at throughout the course of our process. So that was more a consistency change, just to make sure that everything was lined up.
It kind of implies, I mean, it could be a little confusing, but if you don't remove, it's not a forest practice. I'm not sure that that's the intent, but anyway, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I have a question kind of along the same lines. It's not exactly the same, but it has to do with definitions. Definition of forest biomass means material from trees and wood plants that are byproducts of forest management. So it's only biomass if it's indirectly created.
If it's directly created through the timber industry.
So well, this is byproducts as a...
Right.
That's just sort of odd to me. I mean, it may be that that's where it comes from right now, but that's the sole definition.
Yeah, the intent here is that biomass is not the sole reason for the harvest.
So you couldn't... You're precluding that from any future scenario. Well, that's interesting.
So, in other words, precluding whole tree harvest for the use specifically for biomass production, which is a practice that is in use in other parts of the United States. Forests are being grown in, and it's just for biomass. And this is defining that as not being.
We're talking about slash.
Rachel, you mentioned a couple of times support for finishing the landscape level wildlife habitat assessment models. What's the specific tie-in? Are there data that those models are going to develop that are relevant to the biomass scenarios?
Just to quickly refresh the board, because it was a topic of discussion and recommended in a couple different ways here. And that assessment was, if you remember, was the second element of the board's wildlife work plan. And our agency headed that effort up as a multi-stakeholder scientific group to develop the models. And it was, the thrust of it was to assess all of the current forest practices rules as they may relate to terrestrial wildlife. And there's kind of an intersection with biomass removal in that there are a few of those models, at the very least, that could be utilized if they were finished. And remember that funding wasn't appropriated from the legislature to finish that project. So right now it's mothballed. It's sitting on the shelf waiting to be finished. If those models were to be finished, they could be utilized to assess potential effects of forest biomass on the species that are dependent upon the wood that is being removed. So there is a tie-in to trying to assess possible effects from the biomass activities.
Norm?
I think I could make a little bit of a comment too about the notion of the word byproduct. And that was a recognition and throughout a lot of discussion that the biomass is by far several orders of magnitude lower in value to the landowner that's growing trees. In other words, the most valuable part of the product is that which is going out as logs, and saw logs being, of course, poles being the highest value, and then pulp being the next value, and biomass is still so far below pulp that it remains a byproduct. And it was, again, that recognition that we're not going in to harvest stands of trees simply so that we can turn them into biofuel. We're harvesting stands of trees so that they can be turned into a solid wood product for the most part, and that it's the slash and the debris that remains that is truly the biomass that's harvested for power generation or for hog fuel steam generation in various plants. So it's not the intention to go out there and harvest biomass, it's the byproduct. That's where that discussion came from.
Other questions for Rachel and Mark?
Not a question, but just a quick comment. Just as Rachel started her testimony, two of our other committee members came in, and we don't typically have representatives from the pulp and paper industry. So George Cave and Evelyn Mielfeller were steady participants throughout this process, and as I say, we don't typically have representatives from that industry. I wanted to recognize their contribution, steady contribution, and their presence here today.
That's great.
I just wanted to clarify the rules recommendations. Those are not urgently needed. We're not being asked to embark on rulemaking relative to these.
This group was asked to convene to look at the forest practice rules and how well they would address the removal of biomass, and that the group would come forward with recommendations at the end of that review. These rules are potential rules that the board could consider to add to the forest practice rules, but there is at this time no sense of urgency for any of these rules.
So given that, what do you see as the next step? Is there any indication of forward motion on this in any way?
Yield to Rachel other than to say that the group does see the need for a continuing ongoing review at a regular basis. We're seeing it as in five-year increments. At this time, the rules overall are very adequate to address forest biomass. There are some of these little other issues such as funding to complete the LOWA. Knowing though that the board does not have a funding or the ability to appropriate monies, but instead to support efforts. So I don't know if you want to add.
Yeah, and I think a lot of given what Mark just said about we were tasked to give recommendations to you, so in many ways we're waiting for guidance from the board as to what our next steps ought to be. So I know that there is a lot of energy and a lot of willingness in this room to move forward, but it wasn't under our purview to identify how, so.
Okay. So it's in our hands now. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Good work. Next agenda item is the annual report from the Cultural Resources Roundtable with Jeffrey Thomas and Pete Heide as the co-chairs. Good afternoon, Jeffrey.
Good afternoon, and thank you. I'm afraid Peter won't be able to join us today, so I'll be speaking on behalf of both co-chairs in the FY 2012 Cultural Resources Roundtable Annual Report. So thank you for inviting us to present today, and I give you a small overview of what I'll be covering here within the next 15, 20 minutes. And so I'll just describe a little bit about the Cultural Resources Roundtable membership, the 2012 work activities, highlighting things involving LAP 222-2120, the Cultural Resource and Protection and Management Plan, which we refer to as the CRUMP, the CRUMP Cultural Resources Types, the CRUMP Cultural Resource Types Video Project, and the CRUMP Use and Effectiveness Survey Project. I'll also talk a little bit about the CRUMP Outreach and Education. Then I'll close by talking about anticipated activities for FY 2013 and give you a little bit of wrap up. So the roundtable members, as we've noted, I am our co-chair, Jeffrey Thomas, Puyallup Tribe of Indians, as is Peter Heide, Washington Forest Protection Association. We have active members. In fact, I'll just say anybody and everybody in TFW that wants to be a part of the roundtable, certainly always welcome. But as for the active members, I'll go ahead and mention Sherry Felix and Lee Stilson of the Department of Natural Resources, Stephanie Kramer and Gretchen Taylor of the Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, David Powell of Yakima Nation, Justine James with Quinault Nation, Dave Burlingame with Cowlitz Tribe, and Robert Bass and Jesse Narag of Hancock Forest Management. All these individuals are very vital to our work, and we certainly appreciate all of their input and dedication. So as far as our 2012 work activities go, I did describe that there's four main areas involving 222-2120, a cultural resource types video project, a CRUMP's use and effectiveness survey, and our general outreach and education work. Maybe to just give you some general statements about our 2012 efforts. We believe that the 222-2120 rule language proposal is important because it clarified expectations and procedures which would apply while fulfilling the requirements of the WAC. And we believe that the cultural resource types guidance video is important because it helps landowners and managers understand the site types that they might find when they file their forest practice application or evaluate their intended proposal. The use and effectiveness, the CRUMP use and effectiveness survey is important because there is a WAC 222-08-160 that does ask for an assessment of how rules and voluntary processes are working, and it explicitly specifies the CRUMP. And so this last year, we've been able to complete an effectiveness survey requested by the board. So we'll tell you a little bit more about that. In terms of the 2120 rule revision recommendations, this was work that was continued from 2011 that hopefully you're all familiar with in some form or fashion. And of course, there were comments that were solicited during the pre-CR 10230A rule revision process. And those comments did result in an additional recommendation to the board to revise the title of the section. So the roundtable had actually recommended some original language without a title change, and then later came back and said, let's add a title change into that as well. And so that was the package that went ahead, went out for CR 102 review. During the CR 102 review process, there were certain tribes that did maintain their ongoing concerns about the sufficiency of the process, especially when it came to tribal notification and consultation. So just want to make sure you're well aware of that. Not all tribes really felt that everything went as smoothly as it might have been. But either way, of course, the CR 222-2120 revision proposal was adopted by the board at the February 9th regular quarterly meeting. and maybe early feedback, including that for my program, is that it has improved the process. That there are, it does provide mechanisms that weren't there before and expectations that weren't as clear about what everybody's trying to do. So the improvements seem to have been favorable. Of course, there's probably always room for a little more. So I would be surprised if you heard me coming back and talking about some of those ideas as well. But let's just leave that for the future. As far as our cultural resource types video project, we felt really lucky to complete this as maybe the first item of the Cultural Resource Protection Management Plan guidance documents that we've been talking about during the year that we'd like to see posted on the DNR website. So we are developing some guidance documents to go along with the Cultural Resource Protection Management Plan. The first one completed at this point is this video project that will is expected to be posted on the DNR website that people can then just click on and they can see a video involving cultural resource types. The roundtable wants to recognize Lee Stilson for having done the PowerPoint presentation. He prepared it. He was invited to present this to the Quinault Tribal Council and staff by Justine James, one of our roundtable members. And so they did that presentation. It was reported on April 25th. By Matt McLaughlin of the University of Washington. I think he's out of the School of Forestry. And the filming and production efforts were supported by a donation from the WFDA. That was also arranged by Peter Heide, the co-chair of our group. And this video is available, and there's a website that's identified there within the report. We're pretty pleased to have this particular video project completed already and hopefully being posted to ASAP. And of course, we are looking forward to completing the rest of our guidance documents during FY2013, so I'll mention some of that later. As far as the Cultural Resource Protection Management Plan Use and Effectiveness Survey Project, which we really do appreciate the board assigning to the roundtable as responsibility and overall project to complete. So thank you for recognizing the CRUMP. Thank you for recognizing that it does use and effectiveness of the CRUMP does need to be evaluated. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to conduct the survey and then report the results back to you. It was really a pretty major project for our group, and so we went ahead and completed it as using the mechanisms available. I think we felt we would have liked to have better resources to work with, maybe a tighter fix on what others' expectations were or might be. But either way, we went ahead and set it out. And we polled ourselves, as well as maybe some of the TFW constituents, to see what should be in such a survey. And so then we went ahead and put it together. It was fairly general in nature. We basically just went through the CRUMP and said, how would you evaluate the different provisions and components that are in the document at this time? And so that survey was sent out, and we did get so I'll tell you a little bit about the respondents. What it said about successive collaborations as mandated through the CRUMP, how well people know about the CRUMP, and whether it's tying to cultural resources training, and just basically how well is the CRUMP working. So as far as respondents, we did have 47 of them, which isn't too bad, and the highest response rates were from Southeast and Pacific Cascade regions. Of those respondents, 43% were owners, managers, or natural resource specialists with a private or industrial scale. Forest land ownership. So about almost half of it came from industrial forest land ownership. And then of the half of respondents that were, of those that were represented forest land ownership, around half of them were from large industrial forest land owners, and the other were from less than 100,000 acres. So about half of them were over 10,000. Oh, let me see. I think I might have a typo here. So let's just flag that one because I hadn't really caught that. As we reviewed half of the respondents, it says were representing a total acreage of forest land greater than 10,000. The other half represented more than 100,000. So I think our 10,000, 100,000 numeric there might be a little bit confused. So just a little quick flag as we continue rolling forward. So on successive collaborations, and you know, maybe just that that observation that I've just now made does reflect how tricky it can be to really come up with to make good meaningful results of the feedback you receive through the surveys, and it's not necessarily always easy to report or even double check. And so we're kind of working quick and dirty towards the end there to make sure that you got your survey report. And so I think you can pretty well trust in the information that's here. That might just be one numeric correction.
Excuse me, can I just ask a question as you're doing this? This is all really interesting. But this does not reflect the current changes, correct?
The current changes of the Cultural Resources Protection Management Plan?
Yeah, or what I mean is the communication part of it, at least, that we just...
It does not, it was circulated after the WAC 22220 revisions of February were, had been accepted, because it was circulated around May and June. But there isn't questions here about the WAC 22220120 rule revision or anything relating to implementation of 22220120 other than maybe its indirect relationship to the Cultural Resources Protection and Management Plan document per se, which is what the survey itself was focused upon. So it wasn't the rule, it was the CRPMP.
Well, I was just wondering if the improvements that are there in terms of notification and communication are reflected in these responses. And I'm guessing that maybe not.
Maybe not. I don't think that we had a way to really, I don't think we had a question that was really specific to that. I think we were focused more upon how well the CRPMP is working, not how well the WAC may have been affecting the implementation of CRPMP, which we would hope would wrap it up. So maybe based upon the components of the CRPMP as is, in which if I think, reflect on that a little bit, has very, very little, if any, reference back to WAC 222-2120 within the main body of the plan. I think that your references to 222-2120 are going to be found more within the appendices, and we have put that out as Appendix C for how you might. Their recommendations for how DNR might better implement 222-2120. So, yeah, there's a little bit, you know, the relationship is definitely acknowledged within the CRUMP. But as for the existing rule or rules, there's, from what I can remember, really no reference to them back within the plan. But of course, that's our living document, and that's the whole idea behind the CRUMP assessment work, is to determine whether or not there are changes to the CRUMP that would be in order, which in the past we've more or less just entertained in a relatively informal fashion by conducting biannual review, as was specified in the CRUMP would happen, and then the value for undertaking that started to come into question as we started to provide, as we entered into the era of being recognized by the board and providing regular quarterly and annual reports. Then the group started to question how valuable the biannual review requirement within the CRUMP really continued to be. And so now we're more or less transitioning away from our earlier biannual review of the CRUMP to an annual report to the board, which will now include a yearly use and effectiveness survey, which we've now just completed our first go round, and are definitely looking for how we're going to improve both the survey effort come 2013, and we have some ideas I'll mention, as well as how we'll continue to improve our annual CRUMP evaluation effort, which means, is there something here we might want to change? So surveying people and saying, what do you think of it, isn't the same as asking, as the group then asking itself, what do you think of it based upon all of the feedback, and do you, is there any recommended change? And a recommended change could be to add more content within the plan that would otherwise reference 222-2120 and how the two relate. I hope I didn't lose everybody as I laid out the rationale. Okay, so let's move on to successive collaborations, if I could. And again, we had sort of a category within the crop reuse and effectiveness survey document that said, how well is it working in terms of facilitating collaboration? Because that's what you're all about. And so 68% of the respondents did note that they had participated in a meeting with tribes and landowners, maybe as per 222-2120. So there is already, we didn't say, okay, did you meet with the tribes specific to 222-2120, but did you meet with the tribes? Maybe in consideration of 222-2120. 88% of the time, the plans, their work plans agreed to of those that had participated in the meeting. So that says that those meetings are more likely to be of essential value. But I will note that half of the tribal respondents stated that they had successful meetings with industrial landowners, but yet 22% of the tribes said they weren't successful, and even 27% said that they were still having a difficult time. So hard again to say whether or not 222-2120 is playing a positive, negative, or maybe yet uncertain role in these dynamics. Maybe the last one I'll point out there, 20% of tribal respondents stated that their cultural resource communications with small forest landowners were successful, but 44% responded that some but not all of their communications were successful. So again, still need more attention on the way that tribes and small forest landowners are really able to work together. As for the knowledge of the cultural resource protection management plan, that people really know it's there, let alone be using it, seems like the knowledge about it is fairly good, but people still feel that there's a need for training. 28% of them said they haven't gotten any yet. 30% of them said that it's been fairly minimal, only 5 to 8 hours of training, that kind of thing. So that's just maybe another observation on continued needs. And as far as how the CRUMP is working, when it just comes to how well they think it's working, 17 said it's working very well, only 2 said not working at all. So, quite an overview, quite a range of thoughts and possibilities, that kind of thing. That the overall trends seem to be positive regarding the effectiveness of the CRUMP. The survey also identified a perceived need and desire for cultural resource training. So, those are two highly important results, for 2013 work. As for our future survey, we recognize that could benefit from maybe different strategies and refinements. So we're thinking that maybe we can create surveys now that have fewer but more focused questions that are designed for specific groups such as small forest landowners. One idea is to target a stakeholder group each quarter so that then they can be preparing their constituents for participating in the survey. Like quarter one would be for industrial landowners, or for private landowners. Quarter two would be for state agencies. Quarter three, environmental groups. Quarter four, tribes, that kind of thing. So that way each caucus then could get their particular constituency ready to really respond to the survey that would be actually tailored for their group. So we're thinking maybe that's a different rate of time for 2013. I'll go ahead and try to wrap up now just by mentioning a little bit about our outreach and education and the 2013 anticipated activities. So as far as outreach and education for our group went in 2012, we did have a chance to at least chime into a discussion that involved potential legislation considered during the 2012 session. We felt that that was important for us and for forest practices because it basically helped agency perform their function as well as improve our understanding of cultural resource issues associated with forestry practices. So we heard that there was legislative issues. We did our best to work with the agency in regards to those issues because we felt that we could help them and that we would help ourselves in return. So we're trying to figure out how do we fit into that legislative conversation a little more meaningfully if and when we do. So that's something on the outreach and education front. Also, we were invited to speak at a cultural resource protection and management training session. It was focused upon forest managers. It was sponsored by the WMPA and Washington, as well as Western Forestry and Conservation Association. That took place last November. Peter couldn't make it, so I went ahead and did a PowerPoint presentation on that day. But we've, of course, also done the quarterly reports and the annuals. We're always looking for feedback on the quarterly reports, which of course come in the form of an action items list or the annual report, which of course you have before you today. But we're always looking for the feedback. It's difficult to just have a one-way communication effort. So just anything you can do to keep it coming back to us, so much the better, because we really want to serve your needs. Let me just say a little bit about 2013, I'll wrap right up. In 2013, we're going to continue our work on our guidance documents, the CREMP guidance documents, which will focus on implementing regulatory and voluntary protection. I have a draft copy of our guidance documents at this point. Let me just mention a couple of the guidance document themes just so that you'll have some idea of what this is really all about. So we've already mentioned the video about cultural resource type. We'll create guidance on what is a cultural resource, what to expect during the landowner tribal meeting, how to set it up, how do you document it, how do you complete a successful site protection plan, how do you work on question 13 of the CEPA checklist, what do you do for tribal outreach, education, contact, that kind of stuff. So, just all those things are within those guidance documents that we're really hoping to bring to finality here during this upcoming year. So, we also hope to prepare a short PowerPoint presentation that could be presented like out at DNR regional meetings or monthly meetings or just whatever, breakfast meetings, where it just really describes what's the CREMP about, what's the cultural resource roundtable about, that kind of stuff. Whatever we can do to carry the cultural resource message to the field. We also want to take at this time, text-based guidance documents and start converting them into internet-friendly media, however that might occur. And we also would like to expand the Cultural Resources Roundtable presence on the board, the DNR, and any other TFW FFR web pages. So we're just figuring out where can that be heading and how can we join along. All together, we eventually want to extend the audience of our cultural resource information to the younger generation of the community and forestry professionals, forest landowners, just anybody else in the forest industry, but the kids. That's where we really think that we really need to be focusing more effort today. So we want to reword our message to attract social media users. So that's something else. Hopefully, we can converse more about together as time proceeds. All in all, thanks to the goodwill of each of the active members, the roundtable is able to make progress. Still remains a critical limitation to the rate of our work. There's no such thing as a free lunch, as they say, but you guys will be getting some pretty good product here at a pretty low cost so far. And I guess the point is we could improve the product maybe with a little more investment, so we really should encourage you to help that happen. Altogether, the roundtable joins all of the TFW stakeholders in taking pride in these and future TFW FFR related accomplishments. And so we do thank you for your genuine interest and attention. Any questions? comment.
It's more of a comment. It's really great to see this report. I'm really glad you're doing the survey work. I think you'll learn a lot from that. It's just sort of interesting to try to read this. It's not a huge sample, so it's easy to overread these percentages. It just looks to me like the non-tribal respondents are somewhat more satisfied with the process than folks on the tribal side. So that's just sort of interesting to note. I'm glad to see that 75% evidently said that they felt like the collaborative discussions were successful with tribes, although it sounds like tribes have maybe a little bit different opinion on that. Maybe it wasn't quite as successful from their standpoint. But anyway, I think this sort of survey is very important. The sort of analysis is very important going forward. And I'm interested in seeing this video about cultural properties, and I would encourage the whole board to check into that, because I think we need to educate ourselves a little bit on what, when we're talking about this, what are cultural properties? Because I've seen some stuff from DOP on it, and I was actually pretty surprised at what some concrete examples are. So I'm looking forward to seeing this myself, and I think it's going to be a good tool along with these other ones you're talking about developing.
Okay, here.
And Jeffrey, I'd ask you to pass along to the entire committee our thanks for a year's worth of good work. You're doing very important work, and we value that very much.
I'm sure they'll appreciate hearing that. Thank you very much. I will do that.
Okay, next agenda segment is opportunity for public commenting on rulemaking on legislative changes to conversion activities and forest practices applications. No comment? So with that, I'll call Gretchen up to address that rulemaking.
Good afternoon, board members. Chairman Young, nice to have you here today. I'm Gretchen Robinson, and I'm here to request your approval to file rule language for public review concerning conversions and applications and several minor clarifications and corrections. As I indicated in my memorandum to you in your board materials, some forest practices rules are out of date because of legislation that has taken place in the past few years. And so, the main purpose of this draft rule language is to update the rules accordingly. Several rules need to be adjusted a bit to show that a year has been added to the forest practices application, the duration of the effective term of the forest practices application. Chapter 222.20 WAC needs to be updated to show that there's a new process involving notice of conversion to non-forestry use in situations where a landowner has conducted uncommitted conversion activities. The term lands platted after 1960, this is no longer an automatic trigger for Class 4 general classifications. So that criterion needs to be deleted from the rules. And finally, forest practices applications on certain lands within urban growth areas should not be classified Class 4 general if the landowner provides documentation that they plan to maintain their lands in commercial timber production, and in cases where the local government has assumed regulatory jurisdiction for forest practices, the proposed forest practices are on 20 or more contiguous forest land acres. For this rule package, a cost-benefit analysis is not required because it only incorporates state statute without material change. And if you approve, then the language will be available for public review for about a month, probably mostly the month of September. We plan to schedule a hearing to take place in the beginning of October, and we will accept comments until after the hearing has taken place. We'll analyze the comments then and incorporate appropriate changes. We'll send a revised rule package to you prior to your November meeting for you to consider adoption. Any questions?
Questions for Gretchen?
Hi, Gretchen. Several of these WACs implicate Ecology's authorities under the Clean Water Act. And on behalf of Stephen Bernath and myself, I want to thank you and other DNR staff for working with us on this draft language. And for the record, I just indicate that we are on board with this draft language going out. So,
thank you. It was very helpful to be working with you. Thank you.
Is there a motion at this time that anyone would like to make?
Come on, Dave, you can read it.
Yeah.
My eyes are blurry.
Norm.
Oh, no. Is that better, Dave? You want
to
do it?
Oh, no.
I move the Forest Practices Board approve for public review the rule proposal amending Title 222 WAC and direct staff to file a CR-102 proposed rulemaking to initiate rulemaking. This proposal incorporates provisions of the second and gross substitute Senate Bill 6406 relating to forest practices applications and incorporates other changes made to RCWs as indicated on page.
We have a second for that motion.
I'll second.
Okay, second it. Discussion on the motion? No discussion. So I'm going to call for a vote on the motion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All opposed, please say nay. Okay, the ayes have it. It's unanimously passed, 13-0. Thank you, Gretchen.
Thank you very much.
Our next agenda item is public comment for rulemaking on WAC 222-16080, critical habitats. No one has signed up to testify on that, so we'll move right along to the rulemaking and invite Sherry to come up and put that before us.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the board. My name is Sherry Felix, and I'm part of the policy group, policy and services section of the Forest Practices Division. Per my memo to you, which is in your board packet, it's my pleasure today to ask your approval to notify the public that you are considering a rulemaking to amend your rule titled WAC 222-16-080, Critical Habitats, State of Threatened and Endangered Species. Staff is recommending that the board consider amendments to this rule because we've noticed clarification is needed to assure wildlife plans are reviewed under the State Environmental Policy Act, or CEPA, and the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife is considering an amendment of the critical habitat definition for gray wolf based on discussions that are going on in the wildlife working group. If you decide today to notify the public that you are considering this rulemaking, staff will file a pre-proposal statement of inquiry with the Office of the Code Revisor, as required by the Administrative Procedure Act. This notice does not obligate the board to any further action. At this point, I'm happy to answer any questions, and we've prepared a draft motion.
Carrie, could you or Dave speak to exactly what DFW is contemplating in their wolf conservation management plan?
Yeah, thank you, Lenny. In the past, I don't know, 2-3 meetings, I guess, I've talked about the fact that element one of the board's work plan on wildlife is the assessment of current rules. And in December of 2011, the Fish and Wildlife Commission adopted the Gray Wolf Conservation and Management Plan. And in that plan, there is a recommendation to review the forest practice rule on gray wolf and make any recommendations that are necessary. And that was based upon the fact that the current gray wolf rule on in 16080 is quite old. It was adopted by the board in 92. and with a whole slew of other critical habitat state rules at that point in time. I think it was a big package. And so we have a memo, you have a memo in your board packet from me under the staff reports that kind of walks through this process and what we're doing. And the rationale for taking a look at that rule comes as the result of the recommendation in the Wolf Plan to do so and to update the rules as necessary. I have convened the wildlife work group, and we've been able to have one three-hour meeting to date, and we have one scheduled and two that will be scheduled with a goal of coming together and developing a consensus recommendation to the board in the relative near future, I believe by November. In November, we need to try to keep on track with this other rulemaking. But I just wanted to voice what our goals are for that particular rulemaking. We're basically responding to the Wolf Plan and following through with our commitment to revisit this particular rule, but also recognize that we still have a listed species. It's still listed as endangered throughout the state by the state, under the state Fish and Wildlife Commission, and it's still endangered on the western two-thirds of the state under ESA. So, but given that, we have an increase in population at the same time, and hopefully we're on our way to recovery. And what that means is that before we hit recovery, and assuming we do, we'll have a higher probability of having an intersection with forest practices on state and private land, especially on the east side. And so we want to recognize current literature, current scientific information, and revisit the rule and to see whether or not it's still appropriate as it's written right now. And so that's why we're going through with this process. And like I said, hopefully we'll be able to continue our work and come back with actual rule language as a recommendation.
So do we have a motion around this?
I'll provide a motion. I move that the Forest Practices Board directs staff to file a CR 101 pre-proposal statement of inquiry to notify the public that the board is considering rulemaking to amend WAC 222-16080. This rule proposal would clarify which wildlife plans are required to be reviewed under CEPA and amend the critical habitat definition for the gray wolf.
Seconded. Discussion around the motion. With no discussion, call for a vote. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion is unanimously passed. Sherry, thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, we will take public comment on the solar radiation study. Chris Mendoza.
Well, again, Board, I just want to be brief here, and basically there's two studies before you. This is one. I'll take this opportunity, hopefully, to comment on them both, so I won't take up any more of your time. But this morning there's a lot of discussion about the CEMA process and how things aren't working on that on one project, but I wanted to remind the board that, for the most part, as I mentioned earlier, CEMA does a good job of getting their work done, and these two reports are examples of that. And so I don't want the board leaving today with the impression that all our monitoring projects that we do end up like post-mortem. And as I said earlier, that's sort of the first time for that that process to fall apart the way it did. We've gone through a lot of projects over the years since Forest Fish was signed. And for the most part, the committee does come together. They do produce reports like this that then go to policy and makes decisions about what to do about that information. So I think these two reports in themselves speak to that. And then lastly, I'd like to just say concerning this morning's discussion about postmortem, you know, there's a, while I respect Kevin's comments about during that period, you know, Kevin's really good at policy, as that's his place, he's very skilled at it, but you know, frankly, when it comes to CMER, myself and others on CMER are the ones that are stuck with, you know, pretty much attending those meetings on a daily basis and following our process. So I just want to make clear that, you know, CMER generally, when we follow our rules, there is, well, I think, it, as he said, issues do not linger for years. Our process doesn't allow for that. In other words, if you have an issue, it's settled immediately. And technical changes that are made are conveyed immediately back to CMER members on a monthly basis. So the notion that people have issues for years, it just doesn't happen, because if it did, then we'd never end up with things like this. And we, you know, we don't also approve things with caveats. That would be another recipe for disaster. So, you know, once things move along, you know, people are pretty much updated on a monthly basis on how things, how projects, if they change, how they change, and in what manner they change. So I just want to make it clear that we do that, protocols and standards manual I brought up here earlier lays all that stuff out in a pretty clear message, so that we don't get our communications crossed in that way, which is, and as I said before, and I'd like to emphasize this, if folks follow those rules, then we do end up with reports like this. Thank you very much for your time.
Excellent. Which will bring us to contemplation of the solar radiation study. Jim, could you set that up for us?
Good afternoon. Before I start, I'd usually like to acknowledge authors if they're here. On this study, the authors aren't, but there's another person I would like to acknowledge. She is here. And that is Terry Jackson. And I would characterize her as the primary sponsor of this project early on. She kind of fell off. We hired project managers, and they kind of took over managing the project. But early on, this was one of, let me just say euphemistically, this was one of Terry's babies. So CMER recently completed the study report, Evaluation of the Effectiveness of Current Shade Methodology in Eastern Washington for Measuring Attenuation of Solar Radiation to the Stream. Attenuation, I'll define a little later. Basically, loss of intensity or reduction of signal strength. In this case, it would be loss of shade or reduction in shade. Just to remind you that, I think you've heard already today enough times, but I'll just remind you of the process, that when CMER completes a study, that study then goes to policy. And policy tries to determine what kind of recommendation it should make to the board, whether it be rule change, guidance change, such as board manual, or possibly no action at all, or action at some future date. So obviously there will be a I'm going to recommend a motion at the end of my presentation, but just to remind you that as we complete, as CMER completes these studies, they come to you through policy with recommendations, and those recommendations can either be some kind of action or no action at all. So the purpose of this study was to evaluate whether there was a significant change in the amount of solar radiation reaching the stream following harvest under what's called the all available shade rule. So it's important to understand what's meant by all available shade rule. In Eastern Washington, riparian timber harvest prescriptions pertaining to shade differ depending upon whether or not you're in the BTO, the bull trout overlay, or you're outside the bull trout overlay. When a harvest unit is located within the bull trout overlay, only those trees that don't contribute to shade and don't contribute to other basal area, for example, objectives, are allowed to be harvested within 75 feet of the stream. If you're outside the bull trout overlay, then and following what's called the standard rule, so you've got the all available shade rule, and then you have the standard rule. Under the standard rule, you can harvest a portion of trees depending upon elevation and canopy cover existing prior to harvest. This study was meant to answer the following critical question: does the removal of trees that lie within 75 feet of the stream that don't qualify as providing shade according to the all available shade rule affect solar energy reaching the stream? In other words, is the all available shade rule effective or not? Based on the results, pretty simple, the authors concluded that the application of the all available shade rule did not cause a significant or detectable increase in average solar radiation reaching the stream surface or cause a decrease in solar attenuation or shade in the 16 streams studied. So based upon that, policy recommends no action be taken at this time based on this particular report.
Questions for Jim?
And there's a temperature study on its way.
Okay, on its way is a companion study called the Temperature Shade Study, also in the BTO overlay, to determine whether or not there's an effect on stream temperature. So this particular report didn't report on any kind of increases, decreases, or whatever based upon the removal of the trees on stream temperature. The other study will. So the results from this study will be combined with the results from the other study to determine whether or not there ought to be any kind of changes in rule or guidance. And, you know, as far as, since we're on that study is very close to coming to CEMER for sending off to ISPR. It's under its second round of review.
I should offer the motion. Paula, question?
I just had a quick process question. So when this study came to policy, was there any nuance in the discussion or anybody that was sort of dissatisfied? Or, I mean, this seems really straightforward.
On this one?
Yeah,
no,
this seems really straightforward.
This one was very straightforward.
Went right there. Okay.
Yeah.
Just, Jim, can you repeat what the timeline is on the companion study? Just quick catch that. On the east side right here.
Yes. I'm just trying to.
You said
so a draft has already come to RSAG. They provided comment, went back to the author. The author has done a second revision of the draft. It's now back to RSAG. I believe because of vacation schedules and such not, that it won't be coming officially back to RSAG for a review and comment discussion until the September RSAG meeting, which is the middle of September. That tells me that if we're lucky, it'll come to CEMER for approval to go to ISPR sometime in October or November. Unless there's major changes again, which in case it'll go back to the author.
Any other questions for Jim? Would a board member care to make a motion?
I'll make the motion. I move that the Forest Practices Board accept the Forest and Fish Policy Advisory Committee's recommendation to take no action at this time on the solar radiation study.
Any discussion around the motion? Okay, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. Jim, thank you. And at this time, we'll take public comment on the west side buffer characteristics, integrity, and function study. Okay, no public comment. So Jim will hold you up here to put that in front of the board.
Thank you. I'm on my own on this one. One of the primary author was going to be here to answer any specific questions about the results. He must have gone on vacation early, because he was going to go on vacation. So this study is called the West Side Type N Buffer Characteristics, Integrity, and Functions Study. This one falls under the Type N Riparian Effectiveness Research and Monitoring Program under the Type N Riparian Prescription Rule Group. The purpose of this study was to evaluate the effectiveness of West Side Type N riparian prescriptions by monitoring changes in riparian stand conditions, buffer tree mortality, shade, wood recruitment, and soil disturbance. And the overall objectives of the study were to obtain an unbiased estimate of post-harvest conditions associated with the Western Washington type N riparian prescriptions, evaluate the magnitude and duration of change in comparison to untreated reference sites, identify site and stand attributes that influence the responses, and determine the proportion of type N riparian prescription treatment sites that met FFR performance targets for soil disturbance. Through these objectives, CEMER hoped to answer three critical questions. How do survival and growth rates of riparian trees change following type NP buffer treatments? Are riparian processes and functions provided by type NP buffers maintained at levels that meet forest practices, HCP resource objectives and performance targets for shade, stream, temperature, large woody debris recruitment, litterfall, and amphibians, and what is the frequency and distribution of windthrow and forest practices buffers? This study has had a lot of results, and some of them were pretty obvious. You have fewer trees in a clear cut than you do in a buffer after a park. As an example. And if you do have a clear cut, there's obviously less potential for recruitment, at least in the short term, than there is if you have a buffer left. So what I did is I decided to select the results that I thought I would highlight some results that I thought might be the most important that came out of the study, and that actually resulted in dispute resolution at policy, a dispute being called. And so I've got three of them. First was, wind was the dominant cause of tree mortality following harvest in the 50-foot buffers. In the first 3 years of post-harvest, there were four windstorms of moderate intensity, moderate meaning 40 to 60 miles per hour. And the mortality rate in the buffers was significantly greater than in the reference sites. So there was significantly more mortality in the buffer zones than there were in the reference sites. During years 4 and 5, there were two powerful storms, defined as greater than 60 miles per hour. And the mortality rate in the 50-foot buffers was not significantly different than the mortality rate for the reference sites. In fact, the reference sites caught up in terms of mortality. So that over the five-year post-harvest period when treatments were measured, the rate of change in stand density was similar in the 50-foot buffer and the reference sites. When you take the combination of the powerful and moderate storms, over time you ended up, basically in this study anyway, with the same mortality rates in the reference sites and in the buffers. Finally, soil disturbance performance targets was met on all 50-foot buffers, and there were 13 sites. The three PIP sites and some 7 out of 8 clear-cut patches. So basically, on 23 of 24 patches, the soil disturbance performance targets were met. That was good news. Based on these results, and because I indicated there was dispute resolution, so obviously there were some agreements made to resolve the dispute, policy has agreed to focus a bit more on wind-related research and monitoring in the future. The first is that they're going to consider wind as part of the Type N strategy review that's currently going on. And by the Type N strategy review, I'm talking about the first priority in policies work list that Steve Burnett talked about this morning. They will request that CEMER consider windthrow in future studies, if appropriate. And that it also consider in the future a separate study on windthrow. When it develops its windthrow strategy, when CEMER develops its windthrow research and monitoring strategy. And then finally, that when the west side type N riparian buffer effectiveness hard rock projects completed, and we have those results, that we include the results of the what we call the BCIF study along with those. What's missing in the BCIF study is any measurement of temperature. But we do have measures of temperature in the hard rock study. So that by combining the BCIF study along with the results of the hard rock study, policy believes it can make stronger recommendations if they're needed to the Forest Practice Board. So based on the results of this study anyway, policy recommends that no action be taken at this time.
Questions for Jim?
When is that hard rock study supposed to be done that has temperature results?
2014. So they are now completing analyses and they are into actually writing chapters, but there's multiple chapters. And I believe they expect to have a first working draft done by the end of late winter, early spring of this coming year. Then obviously it goes to the SAGs, it goes through CEMER, it goes to ISPR, comes back for revision, and that's why the 2014 date.
Any other questions for Jim? Would a board member care to make a motion?
Derek? Mr. Chair. I just want to note, there's certainly no harm in taking a vote on a motion, but certainly not necessary to have a vote on a motion to do that. So it's at your discretion, obviously, but it's certainly not necessary.
I'll start one way, so I'll finish that up. But thank you for the clarification. Would a board member care to make a motion?
I can do that. I move the Forest Practices Board accepts Forest and Fish Policy Committee's recommendation to take no action at this time on the West Side Buffer Characteristics, Integrity, and Function Study.
Second.
Okay, seconded. Any discussion around the motion? So, Norm.
Just on the point that Darren made, given that we have received a report and we have discussed it and had a presentation, I think it is a good idea to, even if we do take no action, just simply to document that so that it's not thought that it was ignored.
Yeah, that's
a good idea. Okay. So with that, I will call for a vote if there's no discussion on the motion. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion's unanimously adopted.
If the board will indulge me, I would like to, the primary author did show up. He thought this was going to be at 3 o'clock, and obviously it was earlier. I'd like to recognize Dave Schuett-Hames. He's one of our CEMER staff researchers. And he's in the audience, so I'd just like to acknowledge that the work that Dave put into this.
Before you leave, I'm not sure if Jim is going to be coming back up before us again.
No,
we have him for one
more. Oh, I do. I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I just wanted to kind of get back to the post-mortem study discussion a little bit. We did it sort of in public comment period. And you, as you point out, here are two examples of CEMER studies that have gone through showing that the process can work. And I feel like we haven't really completed a conversation there, and maybe there'll be a more in-depth discussion down the road, but we have some opportunities coming up with the lean and settlement recommendations going into the AMP process. Mm-hmm. So I want to encourage you as our AMPA to look for some opportunities there for maybe forwarding additional suggestions for the process that might be improved in light of what we're experiencing here right now. And it may be just getting expectations aligned, but there may be ways of clarifying timelines. And not sure what all those can be, but I think we all feel, I don't think anybody disagrees. There's disagreement about what is actually happening right now in the postmortem, but I don't think anybody disagrees that you shouldn't be allowed to do sort of an 11th hour end run on a process thing. And so I'm not saying that's what's happened, but if there's a way to clarify our procedures so that's quite clear that can't happen in the future. We have an opportunity as these AMP reform ideas start to come forward to add maybe to that. And I feel confident that if there's some clarification that's needed, that policy will take that up. And I'll be encouraging my policy representative to look for an opportunity for tightening up our procedures if that's what's needed. So I just want to encourage you to also think about that, and but also encourage you to get this resolved. Waiting 3 months for the other, I don't know the extent to which the different parties are talking, but I just want to encourage you to use your position to move this along, because there's going to be a lot of discussion about what it really means once it gets to policy. What are the appropriate actions? I think that's really where we should be putting our energies.
Right.
So that's all. My little speech.
So just in response to that, one thing that CMER has been doing is CMER has been going chapter by chapter and reviewing and revising its protocols and standards manual. It just recently approved a revision of Chapter 3, and Chapter 3 includes a decision-making process, and part of that, the revised manual is now a diagram that shows, that very clearly shows the process by diagram. But the purpose of the change in process was to get us into dispute resolution quicker. Because once you're in dispute resolution, because a lot of these things just linger and linger and linger,
yeah,
and
exactly.
Nobody calls for dispute resolution. So part of the process, part of Chapter 3 was the successful CMER approval of it, was that we have a different decision-making, at least process now. I think the other part is that, we have, CMER has people, scientists that come and go. And I think ensuring, and training may not be the proper term here, but making sure that as new members come on board, they understand the process, they understand the culture, they understand the context, they understand the background, and that in this case, that prior decisions are prior decisions, and we can't continually go back and revisit old decisions. So I'll use the word training, but there's a training process that we really need to make sure occurs with new members as they come on board.
And for the solar radiation study, I would like to thank Terry for the work that you and your author team did to lead that, and Dave for West Side Buffer, for you and Ashley and Robert and your associates. Thank you for that. So this brings us to the final agenda item of the afternoon, and that is next to final. Is there any public comment on CMER membership?
Yes.
Jim Peters.
Good afternoon. Jim Peters, North Coast Indian Fish Commission. You have a letter of my recommendations for Debbie Kay to be put in as a CMER member. The reason why I wanted to come up and comment on this position is that the tribes have been, and Nancy has been trying to work and recruit qualified tribal scientists to participate in the CMER process. However, we have a number of them that are willing to do that, but their employers are keeping a hold of them and won't release them to the time and the effort that it takes to participate in this adequately. We do have a tribe that's willing to do that now, so I would encourage your this nomination to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Now I'll call Jim Hotbed back up. Jim, is there anything you'd like to add to Jim Peters' remarks?
Yeah, I'd like to add that Debbie Kay, who is the nominee, started attending CMER soon after I took my position, so it's been pretty close to 2 years, if plus or minus. And she agreed. We've had a hard time finding co-chairs for WETSAG, the Wetlands Scientific Advisory Group. And she agreed to take that on as much of a rookie as she was. And, you know, she, to me, she's a little bit of a glue. She's held WETSAG together. They have their regular meetings. They have a project underway. They're currently discussing what wetland function is, what does it mean, because we've had a little bit of a hard time deciding if we have a wetlands effectiveness study, what functions should we be studying, and then how should we be measuring those functions. So she's been a very productive member of CEMER, and I support her nomination.
Is Deborah present in the room today?
No, she isn't. She's actually expecting. There was a WETSAG meeting yesterday. We weren't sure if she would even be there, but she was.
Okay. Questions for Jim around Debbie's nomination? Would a board member care to make a motion? David.
I'll make that motion. I move the Forest Practices Board approve the table two dated August 2012 as the current CEMER roster that reflects Debbie Kay as a member of CEMER.
Any discussion around Debbie's nomination and the motion? Okay, I'm going to ask for a vote. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion is unanimously approved. Jim, thank you. And that concludes our agenda. I understand we have no need for executive session this afternoon, so I'm going to be adjourning the August board regular meeting.
Hey, Lenny, come back in 3 months.